send a message to every kid out there wondering if whatever marks them out as different means they are somehow destined to be less than.
Mayor Pete dropped out of the presidential race over the weekend, but what did he leave behind?
Growing up, I never imagined that there could be a presidential candidate like Mayor Pete.
I'm Duarte Geraldino, in for Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for March 3rd, what did LGBTQ voters take away from Pete Buttigieg's candidacy, and what could it mean for the future of American politics? Also on the show, the next time you buy a meal at a fast food joint or a restaurant, you should know. The person serving you may have felt pressure to work while they are sick.
I've just seen it so many times that a worker calls in saying, you know, I'm sick, I don't want to get others sick, and they say, come in or you'll be fired.
There's more room for a situation like this to get exacerbated in a really bad way because there aren't protections for employees who are, at the end of the day, people.
We got a lot to get to, so let's get going. It's Super Tuesday. Today, voters in 14 states plus American Samoa get to weigh in on the Democratic presidential primary. Later in the show, we find out how Super Tuesday came to be. But first, the race itself. The makeup of the Democratic primary field dramatically shifted in the last few days. Amy Klobuchar dropped out of the race on Monday. Her announcement came less than 24 hours after Pete Buttigieg also called it quits. Both candidates are now endorsing Joe Biden. And in the same breath, Buttigieg also acknowledged the significance of his run. He was the first major openly LGBTQ contender for the White House.
And we sent a message to every kid out there wondering if whatever marks them out as different means they are somehow destined to be less than. To see that someone who once felt that exact same way can become a leading American presidential candidate with his husband at his side.
And here's what may surprise you. Despite the unprecedented nature of his run, most LGBTQ voters did not have Buttigieg's back. According to a Morning Consult poll from late January, 34% of LGBTQ primary voters backed Bernie Sanders, and only 12% listed Buttigieg as their first choice candidate. Now, just because his run didn't connect with most LGBTQ voters, it doesn't mean his attempt to get to the White House wasn't meaningful for gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered, and non-conforming politicians.
Growing up, I never imagined that there could be a presidential candidate like Mayor Pete. My name is Mondaire Jones. I am a candidate for the Democratic nomination in New York's 17th Congressional District. And if elected, I would make history as the first openly gay black member of Congress.
Mondaire hasn't publicly endorsed any of the 2020 candidates, although he has received an endorsement from Senator Elizabeth Warren. Putting policy aside, the New York politician says Buttigieg's campaign did show how far the LGBTQ movement has come in the United States political scene.
He is someone who I think for so many members of the LGBTQ plus community, myself included, has provided inspiration and affirmation of the idea that things really do get better for the community as time passes, that you can be your authentic self and still excel at the highest levels of our society.
But Mondaire says the mayor also fell short in several key areas.
You know, one thing that he would probably tell you and one thing that he has said publicly is that he needs to do more work in terms of developing a relationship to communities of color, in particular the black community. And also, I think in speaking to the urgency of this moment from a policy perspective, queer people of color are more likely to be homeless, are more likely to have difficulty accessing necessary medical care, are more likely to have student debt. And when you look at some of his proposals, they simply do not go far enough.
Overall, what Mondaire is most excited about is the example that candidates like himself and Buttigieg have set for the next generation of openly LGBTQ politicians and hopefuls.
It is just so important that people like myself and Pete provide an example for other people, young and old, by the way, who are still struggling to come out. I just would not have it any other way. And I'm glad to have been running largely at the same time that his campaign existed for the presidency.
And Jonathan Capehart is here with us. He's an opinion writer for The Washington Post and hosts the Cape Up podcast. Hey, Jonathan.
Hey, Duarte.
So, Jonathan, how significant do you view Pete Buttigieg's candidacy?
It's significant in that he was the first LGBTQ American to make a credible run for the White House. And I make that distinction for a reason. He's not the first LGBTQ openly LGBTQ person to run. Remember, Fred Karger ran for the Republican nomination for president in 2012. He was the first LGBTQ person to run. But Mayor Pete was the candidate who was able to take it this far. Not only did he get into the race, not only did he make a credible run for it, that CNN town hall he did last March put him on the national scene a few months earlier than he had hoped. He then goes on to win the most delegates in the Iowa caucuses.
Is that what made him credible, do you think? Is it because he won so much in the Iowa caucuses? Or is there something else for budding LGBTQ politicians that they should take away from Buttigieg in terms of credibility?
Well, I mean, it has to do with Mayor Pete being authentically himself and not hiding who he is, not hiding his husband, not hiding their affection for each other, and putting LGBTQ issues front and center with all of the issues that were facing the country. He's running to be president of the United States, who also happens to be proudly LGBTQ. And so I think what candidates, LGBTQ candidates running across the country should take from Mayor Pete is that if you are authentically yourself and your message resonates with people, the people will rally around you.
Did the LGBT community actually support him? Because there's some data out there that despite the fact that Buttigieg is an inspiration, he didn't actually have the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered vote on lockdown.
No. And, you know, I think that's asking a lot of voters, no matter who they are. Let's keep in mind, Senators Cory Booker and Kamala Harris, African-Americans, were running for president, and they couldn't get the black vote on lockdown. And it wasn't because African-Americans didn't like them, didn't respect them, didn't think they would be good. It's just that African-American voters, as we saw in the South Carolina primary, they already had a candidate, generally speaking, and that's former Vice President Joe Biden. And as I've written and have reminded people, as long as Joe Biden was in the race, no candidate in the campaign could expect to get a majority of black support. And so I think with Mayor Pete, he discovered what all candidates from a marginalized community discover, and that is just because you belong to a marginalized community does not guarantee that that community will automatically support you.
When we think about his support, the assumption is that he had a lot of white gay men who were supporting him. Now, you mentioned that he needed to make some inroads with people of color. Do you think that he can actually change that perspective to bring in more people of color, more women to his support base?
I actually think he can, and he can look to the example of Vice President Biden for that. Vice President Biden has been on the American political scene since he was in his 30s, youngest member elected to the U.S. Senate when he got into the Senate. And one of the reasons why Biden did so well in South Carolina is not only because of the support among African Americans, it was the depth and longevity of their support of him, and also his support of them in South Carolina. If you read the stories and look at Biden's history, he has a relationship with South Carolina that goes back 40 years. And it's not just through campaigns. It's through visiting with his old friend, the former Senator Fritz Hollings from South Carolina, spending time there, building relationships. Those are the sorts of things that Mayor Pete can now do going forward, not only making friends, building relationships, but then strengthening those relationships so that when he does make more credible runs for higher office, that he has relationships to fall back on, not only for political support, but for advice and counsel.
See, at the beginning of the show, you heard from Mondaire Jones Some members of the LGBT community didn't agree with Buttigieg on policy issues. What do you make of people who say he wasn't progressive or intersectional enough?
Well, see, here's the thing. Just because someone is LGBTQ does not guarantee or mean that they are automatically progressive. In the same way that I remember way back when I was making the case that just because someone was LGBTQ doesn't automatically make them a Democrat, that it is possible to be a part of the community and be a conservative or be a Republican or be a moderate, that you did not have to support progressive causes if that was not where your heart and soul were. And so I think we have to, in the LGBTQ community, understand that we, as we love to have the rainbow flag and the rainbow colors talking about the span of who we are, we have to have that apply to our political views as well.
Pete Buttigieg is also a man of faith. How much did his faith play a role in this campaign? How did people view that as a gay man who's married, who also goes to church?
I think for Mayor Pete, his being LGBTQ is integral to who he is, and so is his faith. It's something that guides him. We've seen politicians for decades now who talk about their faith and walk in their faith, as my mother would say. And you can tell when it's genuine and you can tell when it's not. And with Mayor Pete, it's very genuine. And I think what he was doing by talking so openly about his faith is that he's trying to open the eyes of the country that LGBTQ people are people of faith, that there are people of faith, and that they should be welcomed, and that they are welcomed in houses of worship. But also what he's trying to do by openly talking about his faith is snatching back faith for the Democratic Party and snatching it back in a positive way, showing that faith and religion are open and welcoming, unlike the way it's used in the conservative movement as something that's exclusionary and, in a lot of cases, particularly with LGBTQ people, harmful.
Thank you so much. Jonathan Capehart is an opinion writer for The Washington Post. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Duarte.
Hi, it's Theo Louis from New York City. With Buttigieg, what he did is promising, optimistic, and uplifting that after a black man is president for 8 years, that a gay brother was one of the leading contenders out of 24, with a huge following running openly and hailing from the Midwest, embracing his Christian faith, shows that despite some strides taken back lately, there is progress, especially bolstered by young voters.
Hi, my name is Shelley, and I'm calling from Davis, California. He absolutely has made a huge difference for the LGBTQ community. I saw him at a fundraiser in West Sacramento, set up monthly campaign donations, have a bumper sticker on my car, a lawn sign in my front yard, and I'm wearing a Pete 2020 t-shirt right now, even though he suspended his campaign. I have never done any of this for a political candidate before.
This is Renee, and I have to say, I absolutely love Pete Buttigieg. His knowledge and manner actually reminded me very much of Barack Obama, and I feel he was the best choice in the whole field. But unfortunately, you know, America's not ready for a gay president, just like they're not ready for a female one.
Pete was my top choice. He agreed with me on most of the issues, but right behind that was about five of the candidates in second place. So I'm going to be happy to vote for whoever is left.
This is The Takeaway. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to comment on any story or give us your thoughts on any topic. Also, we're on Facebook and Twitter at The Takeaway. Let us know what you think.
They shoot journalists on sight in the Capitol. They literally see us as enemy combatants.
In the new movie, Civil War, the United States is up in flames, and the truth teller is just another casualty.
The movie is using journalism as a lens to show you what happens when social trust breaks down completely.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
If you're not getting paid by the hour, then you know someone who is. And as the coronavirus spreads, hourly workers are facing tough questions about staying healthy while trying to make a living.
You would honestly just have to call around and see if anyone could cover your shift.
Meet Alexandra Bent. Today she lives in Los Angeles, where she's a front-of-the-house manager at a restaurant. But for years, she worked in hospitality in North Carolina. She says it used to get really tough for her when she got sick and needed to take time off from her hourly restaurant job.
If you were lucky enough, you know, talk to your workplace and hope that they can either help you get covered or understand that you're calling out. But there's not really any kind of system or support to help, you know, make that happen or to help people get taken care of when they are having to call out of work. There's no paid sick days at all.
And as you know, she's not alone. Tens of millions of people in the U.S. are hourly employees. So how does it work out if you have to take a sick day?
You don't work that day. And if you're an hourly worker, which almost all of us in the restaurant industry are, you don't make money that day. And that can be really detrimental for people if you're in a situation where you have kids to take care of, you have debt you've taken on, if you're sending money back home to anyone else in other parts of the country or other parts of the world, you lose that, which can be really, really rough.
I asked Alexandra whether pressure to work is coming from the management directly or if it's just understood.
A little bit of both. It's kind of something that's just understood. Management's usually clear about how to, you know, call out about things. I mean, every restaurant has the, you know, OSHA posters that let you know that if you have these health things going on, that you're not allowed to work and that you do have to call out. But not, at least in my experience, most restaurants don't get that time paid for at all. So if you do get sick and have to call out, you just have to call out and hope for the best.
So you walk into the restaurant and you see these big old posters that say that if you are feeling this way, if you have any visible signs of sickness, you have to call out sick, and yet you're not going to get paid. So do you have any incentive to actually call out sick?
No, there's none. Essentially, most of us have the experience where if there's a sickness going around, like a little cold, it's kind of understood that you stay as physically distant from your coworkers as possible, but you know that you might just end up getting the little cold. But if you have bills to pay, which we literally all do, there's absolutely no incentive for not being at work.
And you've seen people come in sick to a restaurant where food is served, where there are vegetables, where anyone could sneeze on it. You've seen this.
Yeah, I have. I mean, I've seen people, you know, not come in because they were really ill and I didn't even see them at their worst. But I've definitely seen people come in and they're still working through a cold, still working through something. And they, you know, they're showing up to work because they don't feel that they feel bad enough to justify losing the money that they would lose if they had to call out.
Your personal situation. How bad do you have to feel before you say, I just can't afford to try to earn this money today?
I mean, I just have to not be able to physically stand or carry on a conversation. That's my main thing. As long as I can, you know, get up and move and I can carry on a conversation. And, you know, if it's like a cold and I know that I'm dealing with a lot of mucus or anything and that would prevent me from a conversation, then yeah, I would have to call out at that time.
Have you ever gone to work in pain?
Oh yeah, but we're always in pain in the restaurant. It's a really physical job. So there's a lot of lifting things. There's a lot of running around. You know, for people who work in the kitchen and the ovens, you're working with really hot equipment. You're working with really sharp equipment. My fiance has been a chef for a little over 10 years, and he's got a ton of scars from various burns that he's gotten working in the kitchen. But there's always room for injury or illness in this business, unfortunately.
Yeah, but there's not really room to call off sick. What about in California? How are things different there?
So California has apparently just done a bunch of changes to make it a really employee-friendly state, which is obviously completely different coming from North Carolina. But you have to give 48 hours of paid sick leave to your employees. So for most of us who work shifts that are an average of like 5 to 6 hours, you know, you're able to call, you have maybe like 5 or 6 shifts that are covered. So if you call out the day that you come back, you just fill out the paperwork and your supervising manager signs it and, you know, approves it. And then once it's past that, it's up to the business whether they are going to approve or deny that paid sick time. But you at least get some days in there, which is incredible coming from where I'm from, which is literally no paid sick days.
So how do restaurant owners, managers in California feel about these new laws? Are they encouraging employees to use the sick days when they feel unwell, or are they not?
I don't really know how it is in general, just because I'm honestly still so new here. I mean, for the most part, most business owners tend to lean towards the side of wanting to make as much money as possible and spend as little as money as possible. So I would say for the most part, they're probably not encouraging that people use it. I mean, it's different right now with the unfortunate risk of coronavirus. You know, we had the handouts given out at my workplace recently, and everyone's been told to really monitor their health and their symptoms. And, you know, right now people are a little bit more encouraged that if you have to call out, please do. But I think hopefully there seems to be a bit more of a change in restaurants in general, that management is trying to take care of their employees more and be, you know, concerned with their overall well-being, and hopefully making sure that we take care of ourselves in the very, like, real medical sense becomes a more common thing.
Thank you so much, Alexandra Bent, for joining us from Los Angeles.
Thank you.
Alexandra Bent is front of the house manager at a restaurant in LA. She spent years as an hourly worker in restaurants in North Carolina. Saru Jayaraman is the author of Behind the Kitchen Door. She closely monitors the legal landscape for restaurant workers. She's also president of One Fair Wage. That organization fights for a full minimum wage for all workers. Now, most healthcare officials urge you to stay home when you're sick, but Saru told me that's just not realistic for restaurant workers.
Absolutely not. Outside of New York City and several other cities that have passed earned sick leave ordinances, 90% of restaurant workers across America don't have the ability to take a day off when they're sick. They're not paid when they're sick. And so that means that they have to go to work. And on top of that, unfortunately, in our country, we have a sub-minimum wage for tipped workers. It's $2.13 an hour at the federal level. A majority of restaurant workers have to go to work to get those tips. They have no choice. Even if they have paid sick leave, they still have to get to work to get those tips. This is the largest and fastest growing industry with the lowest wages. They have no choice but to go to work when they're sick.
Does that fact impact their risk of getting sick on the job?
It doesn't just mean they're at higher risk. It means all of us are at higher risk, because 70% of foodborne illness can be traced back to sick food service workers. The CDC has reported this. We've put out various studies funded by the National Institute for Health. It's quite well known that foodborne illness comes largely from sick restaurant workers. And norovirus in particular, the CDC has noted, comes from sick restaurant workers. And so we are very worried about the spread of disease already. You know, I remember we did a huge study funded by the National Institute for Health, and we interviewed employers across New York City. And one of them said, and I'll never forget this, he said, well, everybody knows it. It's common knowledge that we as the restaurant industry single-handedly spread the flu during this flu season. We're the reason that the flu spreads during the flu season. And it's because workers come to work when they're sick. And of course, they're spreading it through cooking and serving the food. So you can only imagine if that's true for flu, with a virus as spreadable, as communicable as coronavirus. We're in real danger by not providing these workers the ability to stay home when they're sick.
So are large chain restaurants any better at providing sick leave than, say, small independent shops to workers?
Absolutely not. In fact, the chains are largely responsible for why the system is as it is. They belong to and lead the National Restaurant Association, which we call the other NRA. It represents all the chains, and they've been the ones primarily pouring millions of dollars into stopping earned sick leave ordinances around the country and keeping the minimum wage at $2.13 at the federal level, keeping the sub-minimum wage in states like New York. The Restaurant Association has been, you know, engaged in really severe lobbying, and the chains lead that. So no, the chains are no better. And in fact, I would say they're more responsible for the situation.
Last week, Chipotle settled with a worker in New York who was illegally fired for taking a sick day. Can you tell us more about that particular case?
Yeah, it's unfortunately all too common. I've seen it over 20 years working in the restaurant industry, working with low-wage restaurant workers. I've just seen it so many times that a worker calls in saying, you know, I'm sick. I don't want to get others sick. And they say, come in or you'll be fired. I mean, there have been hepatitis outbreaks as a result of workers not being able to take a day off when sick. There have been, as I said, norovirus outbreaks. I mean, there's so much evidence that foodborne illnesses spread, as I said, even from the CDC, because these workers are going to work when they're sick. It's just all too common. And part of the issue is that employers, they rely on people on certain shift, and rather than creating a situation where somebody else could come in their place, they say you either come in or you're fired. There's an expectation that you come in when you're sick in our industry. Beyond the horrible legal situation of having a sub-minimum wage, being forced to live off of tips, not getting in most places a paid sick day, an earned sick day, on top of all of that, there is a certain kind of culture of our industry, machismo in our industry, that you bite the bullet. You go to work when you're sick. You don't stay home. That's just what you do.
So, you know, what advice would you give to people who are dining at these restaurants? What can we do to protect ourselves if you just want a meal? You don't want a virus with that order.
I think it's time for all of us as consumers to demand that restaurants pay their workers and treat them well and provide the ability for these workers to take a day off when they're sick, and also demand from our legislators that they require the industry to provide paid sick leave and provide these workers with a full minimum wage so they don't have to go to work to get those tips even when they're sick. So the best thing that we can do as diners is to demand this from our employers. So we have an app called the ROC National Diners Guide, and it tells you which restaurants provide paid sick leave. You can use that, or you could just go into your favorite restaurant and ask, does this establishment make sure that workers get a full minimum wage with tips on top? Does this establishment provide paid sick leave, you know, pay workers to take the day off, a full minimum wage?
How are conditions for workers in states with stronger minimum wage? Are they less likely to get sick, less likely to transmit some virus to diners?
So I would argue that while we're seeing coronavirus in almost every state now, I think what we're really talking about is preventing the spread of this through food service, through foodborne illness. And that is where we would strongly, strongly urge the state of New York, other states, to really look at paying these workers a full minimum wage and ensuring that they all have paid sick leave. I mean, it is the most important thing we can do if we want to stop the spread of coronavirus through food service.
Thank you so much for chatting with us, Saru Jayaraman, president of One Fair Wage.
Sure. Thank you so much.
We reached out to the National Restaurant Association for a response, and Sean Kennedy, who is Executive Vice President of Public Affairs, told us, quote, all workers are entitled by law to be paid minimum wage, period. He also said coronavirus has a unique quarantine and recovery period that transcends the traditional policy debate surrounding paid sick leave. He went on to say, tackling this challenge requires that employees, businesses, and government officials come together and follow proven procedures proven to protect the health of employees, customers, and communities. Now, if you want to read it for yourself, we've posted the National Restaurant Association's full comment on our website at thetakeaway.org. Now, we've also heard from you at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Hi, this is Suzanne from East Jordan, Michigan. And I'm more concerned for my daughter and her husband, who happen to work in the parks, amusement parks in Orlando. So I'm pretty sure China's already shut down Disney there. Japan is probably about to do the same, given that they are closing all the schools. It's just a matter of time before the California and Florida parks are affected.
Hi, my name is Lauren Gilbert Smith. I'm calling from Dallas, Texas. I'm an hourly rate employee with no benefits. When the schools are closed, I do not get paid. I will fall behind in my bills if the schools are forced to close because of an outbreak of the virus.
This is Chris calling from San Diego. I'm a small business owner. Part of my supply chain is in China, and one of my markets is large public events. So, yes, I'm concerned about the coronavirus, as this is a potential double squeeze for us.
You, an hourly worker whose wages could be affected by the coronavirus, share your story at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 1-877-869-8253. And that's all for me today. I'm Duarte Giraldino, in for Tanzina Vega. I'm back with you again tomorrow on The Takeaway. See you soon.
What's up with our elections in 2020? Why do some states caucus and others don't? Who gets to be a delegate? And yes, everyone goes crazy about Super Tuesday, but what is it and why is it so important? I'm Amy Walter, host of How to Vote in America, a new podcast from WNYC Studios. Every episode, we'll tackle one element of this long and twisted election process and try to make sense of what it actually takes to vote in this country. Listen to How to Vote in America wherever you get your podcasts.